listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Miriam Powell is the author of The Union of Their Dreams, Power, Hope, and Struggle in Cesar Chavez's Farm Worker Movement, a groundbreaking narrative history told through 8 participants in the movement. Her narrative examines the movement, the people drawn to it, the ways they changed history, and the ways the history they made changed them. Historian Kevin Starr wrote of her book, "In this sympathetic yet courageously honest narrative, a seasoned reporter presents the history behind the legend of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers' movement. At the same time, Miriam Powell pays tribute to the dreams of a generation of young Americans dedicated to social justice and the dignity of labor." Miriam Powell spent 25 years as an award-winning reporter and editor on both coasts, directing coverage that won Pulitzer Prizes at Newsday for the 1996 crash of TWA Flight 800 and the LA Times for the deadly 2003 wildfires. In 2006, she wrote a 4-part investigative series for the Times about the United Farm Workers, which led her to delve more deeply into Cesar Chavez's movement and his legacy. She's recently been a fellow at the Alicia Patterson Foundation and a John Jacobs Fellow at the Berkeley Institute of Government Studies. Jim Newton, and if you were here just last week, he was most recently here interviewing Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz for Aloud, is the editor-at-large of the Los Angeles Times. He's a 20-year veteran of the Times and has covered, among other beats, LAPD, the administration of Mayor Reardon, federal law enforcement, the 92 LA riots, and the 94 earthquake. The latter two were awarded Pulitzer Prizes to the staff. He's also an author. He wrote Justice for All, Earl Warren, and The Nation He Made, a critically acclaimed best-selling biography of the former Chief Justice and California Governor. And presently, he's Senior Fellow with UCLA's School of Public Affairs. Please join me in welcoming our authors, Miriam Powell and Jim Newton, to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Miriam will join us in just a second. I just wanted to start by saying this is a really special treat for me. As Louise kindly mentioned, I was here recently interviewing Joseph Stiglitz, but tonight is a really different experience for me because Miriam was my boss. and therefore, now I have the chance to ask her some questions. I worked for Miriam beginning in 2000 when she arrived at the Los Angeles Times to supervise our California coverage and asked me to supervise our state and local government and political coverage. Miriam and I spent several years together doing that and sort of teaching each other. I tried to impart a little bit of what I knew about L.A., and she tried to teach me how to edit. And if I do say so myself, we did some good work. You just heard from Louise about the Pulitzer coverage that Miriam supervised in 2003. She did that after she was unburdened of me when I went off to write my book. But in the meantime, we covered the mayor's race in 2001, the deepening state budget crises of 2002-2003, and the run-up to the gubernatorial recall in 2003. What I learned most about Miriam in those years was the absolute premium that she placed and places on exacting standards. Miriam insists on precision. She is exasperated by sloppy thinking or by the failure to pose sharp questions. She reads with a keen mind and a sharp pencil, and she demands insight. And all of those attributes are thoroughly and quite movingly on display in Miriam's important book, The Union of Their Dreams. As she'll explain to you, this work grows out of a series that Louise mentioned that she wrote for the Times in 2006, after which she followed this time-tested path from newspaper into book writing and transformed the series into this deeply researched, scrupulously written account of 8 members of Cesar Chavez's historic movement. The Union of Their Dreams, like the series that kindled it, is controversial. It refuses to accept the deification of Chavez, despite the heroism that drapes his legacy and that was part of growing up in California for people of my age. But Miriam's respectful skepticism and cool appraisal ultimately may serve Chavez and his union better than the myth that so many of us learned years ago. The Chavez of this book is complicated and flawed. He's petty at times and downright mean, frankly, at others. He's also inspiring and transcendent. More important, though, than all of that, this is the story of those who were drawn to him and his cause, those who gave years, sometimes decades, to the struggles of America's farm workers, the struggles that animated Chavez himself. It's a story that's sensitively and intelligently told by my former boss, my friend, Miriam Powell. Miriam? So, we need to remember that, right? That's the key moment. You want to start by telling us why you wrote the book?
Sure. Thank you for the introduction. And I'm a little nervous now about what questions Jim's been wanting to ask me for all these years. But I wrote this book for several reasons. The book really is a collective biography of a social movement. And I wrote it, first of all, because I think it's an important chapter of history in California and of the history in the country that has not been written about sufficiently and really has hardly been written about at all. I was interviewed recently by an 11th grader who was writing a paper about this and who asked me why this wasn't something that they learned about in high school. And she lives in Seattle, which is still on the West Coast. And let me tell you that when you talk about this subject on the East Coast, people just wonder if Cesar Chavez is still alive, is generally their first question. So it is an important piece of the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement has historically been covered as a story about black and white and about the South and not about the Chicano civil rights movement and not about what happened in the farm workers. So I thought that there was an important piece of history that needed to be told and that there was a way that I could contribute to a small piece of that history. And this is, by necessity, one slice of that story. More than that, probably even I was driven by the people who were in the book and by the people who I met who were part of this movement. I have yet to meet anyone who volunteered for the United Farm Workers movement during its height in the 60s and the 70s who does not say that it was an experience that changed their life and that transformed them and that was in many ways the most important thing that they've done. And, that applies to people who work for the movement for 6 months. And many of them went on to do things that they would not have done otherwise because it was an experience that so shaped their thinking about social movements and about social change. And I wanted to tell that story. And I also found that many people were just still haunted 30 and 40 years later by questions that they had about what had gone wrong and what had gone right, why the movement had ultimately failed to succeed as a labor union, why farm workers today were not working under contract for the most part, as everyone at that point in time assumed would be true. And literally, when I say haunted, I mean people had 30 years later still kind of, what happened? Why didn't it work? What was really going on versus what I thought was going on? And I thought that I was a person who could find some of those answers and who could explain some of them. And I'll stop mm-hmm. there, but those are the reasons I wrote the book.
And did you find those people that so sort of animated you in the book in the course of the series or between the series and the book? How did that all develop?
Both. Some of them I found. The series that Jim has referred to was a four-part series for the Los Angeles Times that ran 4 years ago, and for the most part it focused on what the United Farm Workers had become today, and it was as you said, an investigative piece. But in the course of that, I began to look into the history of the UFW, at first thinking that I was doing that just to understand the present and to be able to put it into context, but ultimately found that the history is so relevant to the past that it became a piece of that story. So many of the people in the book I met for the first time while I was working for the paper and doing the stories. I didn't know, for the purposes of the series, I focused on the latter part of the union when things began to disintegrate and not on the earlier years. So I had to go back. The book is very different. It's very much a story of all of the good things and the remarkable achievements that happened in the early years as well. And so as I got into the book, I met more of the people, and it's sort of a mix.
And did you, as you started the reporting for the book, obviously it was people you were talking to knew of the series. How did their reading of the series affect your ability to get to them and talk to them and get them to participate in the book?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
I think for the most part it was helpful. There were some people who were very upset about the series. It challenged things that they believed deeply, and it was not easy to read for many people. But to a large extent, I think that for years people had not talked about any of this. You know, people who were kicked out of the UFW, people who saw their friends kicked out, people who were very unhappy about how things transpired, did not talk about it, kept it all inside. That's part of the haunting issue.
Speaking of haunting, sorry.
I think for most people, the primary reason they didn't want to talk about it was out of a fear that it would hurt what was still going on. You know, that this was a cause that they cared about deeply, and whatever had happened to them personally was secondary to the larger cause. And as long as the union was out there and was organizing farm workers,
sorry,
like that, as long as there was a fight still going on, they weren't going to be the person who talked about what had happened for fear that it might hurt the cause. To a degree, I think that what my stories did was take away that issue, because to the extent that people recognized that there really wasn't much going on anymore, there was less reason not to talk about this.
Mm-hmm. What about, was there a protectiveness of Chavez and his own personal legacy?
I wouldn't say there was a protectiveness as much as people had to work through their own personal relationships with him. He was such a charismatic figure. He was so important to people that there was a real struggle, and it was, for many people, reading the book was extremely painful, because there was a sort of question of, you know, well, who was this person really, and was he not who I thought he was? You know, what was my relationship with him? What was it that he was really doing at the time? What were his goals? In the end, I think that some of the answers in the book, that the book answers some of those questions by showing his consistency really over time in terms of what his vision was. But people had to come to terms with what was really happening versus what they thought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is, and you should just go anywhere you want with this, but there is a tension, it seems to me, throughout the book between those who see this as a movement, a civil rights episode, a civil rights movement, and those who see it as a union, a struggle for wages, for benefits. How did that tension shape the life of the UFW, and how did it contribute to the story that you're here telling?
It's a central tension throughout the book, as you said, and I think was very key in shaping the history of the UFW. I think that until 1975 was a real watershed moment, because it was the passage of the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, signed and negotiated in large part by the former and potentially future governor of California, Jerry Brown. And up until 75, the UFW, for the most part, was really at war. And then the question was sort of, there was always an enemy, there was always a fight, there was a battle. And Chavez was most comfortable, in his words, in the role of being the nonviolent Viet Cong. And that was a role that he was comfortable in, he relished, and he was great at it. He was a brilliant strategist. And so long as there was a fight going on, I think that those issues sort of merged, that the question of whether we were a union or a movement, what direction, the differences were there early on, and when you go back and you listen to the tapes and the discussions and the issues that people bring up, it's clear that those divisions were there then. But they were sort of masked in the common fight. After 1975, when the law was passed, which is still on the books, and California is the only state in the country that has a law that promotes the organizing of farm workers in the fields. Farm workers and domestics are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. They're the only workers who are not. The ALRA changed that, set up a system that guaranteed elections in the fields, and it is to this day probably the most pro-labor law in the country. Suddenly, there was a bureaucracy. There were elections. Elections had to be won or lost. Contracts had to be negotiated. They had to be administered. So that's the point at which I think the split becomes more, you know, manifests itself. And from there on, it continues to.
And it seems from the book, it seems where that's where Chavez becomes, in some ways, sort of disenchanted with his own success, or the success of the act.
I think that's right. I mean, he did not want a law. He did not support the law. He had no choice, really. I mean, he did support it ultimately. But in 1973, during this very difficult strike in the grapes and battle with the Teamsters as well as with the growers, the AFL-CIO offered him a strike fund of $1.7 million, and he needed the strike fund. And the price for the strike fund was that he agreed to support legislation, because the labor movement didn't want, they wanted peace in the field at some point. They didn't want this war to go on forever. So he reluctantly sort of agreed to this and then proposed this outrageously pro-union law on the theory that this would never actually come to pass, and it did. So while it was on its face a huge victory for the union and for Chavez and for the farm workers, and in many senses it was a victory, he recognized immediately that it took the union in a direction that was not really the one in which he wanted to go.
In a bureaucratic direction, in a sense.
He referred consistently to things like negotiating contracts and so on as non-missionary work.
There you have it.
You mentioned Brown, and obviously Jerry Brown, relevant in our lives today and potentially more so soon. You want to talk a little bit about his role in this book as a young governor? Or first AG and then governor, right? In both? Or am I remembering? I guess, I'm sorry. This is all as governor, right? As
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, is that right there?
Secretary of State. His first role was as Secretary of State, and he was involved in sort of helping the UFW initially in fighting against a pro-grower proposition on the ballot in 1972. Brown's role was tremendously important in terms of the law. I mean, I don't think the law would have happened without Jerry Brown, because he was able to, he really put his own prestige on the line. It was one of his first priorities when he was elected governor, and he delivered on it. And he was able to, I mean, there were many factors that led to the passage of the law. There was widespread civil disobedience, and the counties were tired of these protesters filling up their jails and refusing to leave and costing them money, and the growers were tired of the boycott, and there were a lot of forces that came together. But Brown was able to bring the parties together in a way and did this tremendous round-robin negotiation that was briefly described in the book. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, and it was one of the major accomplishments of his 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Why did you do the book through these 8 characters as opposed to a more conventional biography of Chavez, which I thought you should do, by the way?
You know, when I decided to do a book, I thought a lot about what book I really wanted to write. And there is no good biography of Chavez. It's still a great book to be written. It was not the book that I wanted to write for a number of reasons. I think it's a huge project. I mean, to do it right, I think, is a mammoth job. And what captivated me were the people, as you said in your introduction, who were drawn to the movement. And it was their stories that I really wanted to tell. And I thought that I could shed a lot of light on Chavez and on the things that had happened through this telling their story, but I wanted to tell the story of the movement, and I chose the people to tell it through because I thought that that was a way to make it accessible and to draw people into reading the book. I mean, my goal, I sort of refer to myself now as I went from being a recovering journalist to being an independent historian. That's my career path. But the book is based, all of the quotations in the book and all of the, well, much of the material, but all of the direct quotes come from primary sources, and they're all quotes that were either written or said at the time. And there's this tremendous wealth of material available that enabled me to do that. So I tried to combine the sort of rigorous, as you refer to my rigorous standards, in my historical research, but to sort of draw on my journalism background to write it in a way that would be accessible to people and that people might read even if they did not think they had any interest in this topic initially. So, and I thought that doing it through people was the way to draw readers into the book, that ultimately to me a very human story, and that by sort of telling it through these characters and getting you to care about the characters, you would understand the movement. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a couple of answers ago the tapes. You want to talk about the tapes that you found?
So Wayne State University in Detroit has a labor library, which is the repository for many of the archives of various unions, including the United Farm Workers. And ever since 1967, when there was an archivist who traveled to Delano to convince Chavez to make Wayne State the depository for their archives, everybody who worked for UFW was under instructions to pack up everything and send it to Wayne State. And there are thousands of boxes, and people, anybody who worked on the boycott, anyone who worked anywhere, sort of just packed things up and sent them to Wayne State. And there are thousands of boxes in Wayne State. And so there's just this amazing amount of documentation, because Chavez said that he wanted the history told, warts and all. That was his phrase. And in the interest of doing that, and in believing in the importance of his own history and in the history of the movement, he also, for a period of time, taped things extensively. He taped board meetings, he taped conferences, he taped conventions, he taped conversations. And the tape recorder, there are these boxes of reel-to-reel tapes that are sitting in Wayne State, many of them never been opened. And it's just an incredible resource. It's sort of, you know, it, as a journalist writing about history, you know, we're used to sort of going to something, seeing it, writing about what you see, and having some firsthand sense of it. And here I was writing about something that I never lived through. I did not meet Cesar Chavez. I did not witness or take part in any of these events. And it was, I was sort of lost in the beginning in sort of not having that firsthand knowledge. And yet, the trade-off is having access to these material that, you know, we never would have as a reporter. So it's like being a fly on the wall and listening to the 50-hour executive board meetings, which they had four times a year. But it's a remarkable experience to me. I mean, I was initially, because I knew how time-consuming and costly it would be to listen to a lot of these tapes because they had to be put onto CDs and it was a whole elaborate process. I didn't think I was going to listen to a lot of them. And then once I started, I found them to be just mesmerizing. I mean, you hear people falling asleep and people making jokes and Chavez announcing that tonight we're going to all tell stories into the tape recorder to, you know, for the net future generations. And it's pretty remarkable.
Were the tapes always made with the knowledge and consent of everyone being taped?
As far as I can tell, yes. People expressed surprise that they were on the tapes when I talked to them and didn't know that they existed, but it's quite public. I mean, he'll say, is the tape recorder on? Are we starting yet? So, yeah.
Interesting. The game.
A big part of
the
book.
Tape the game, too.
Right.
Yeah.
tell about the game.
After the law was passed and elections began, as Chavez became sort of increasingly dissatisfied with his ability to sort of maintain control of the organization and get it to run smoothly, he formed an alliance with Synanon, which I don't know how many people remember. Synanon was a drug treatment program that began as a sort of innovative drug treatment program and morphed into a cult, essentially. Its leader, Charles Dietrich, ultimately pled guilty to placing a rattlesnake in the mailbox of an attorney who had successfully sued Synanon. None of this deterred Chavez, who supported Dietrich to the end, very loyal. They had a campus up to in the northeast in the foothills of the Sierras, and everything there, it was clean, it ran, it was perfect. All the people also had shaved heads and wore the same overalls, and there were other various odd things about it, but they always had money, things operated efficiently, and Dietrich's philosophy and his advice to Chavez at this point in time was, if people aren't going along with you, get rid of them. The people who served you before are not necessarily the people who are going to serve you in the future, and if they're not loyal, get rid of them. And one of the tools for doing that was something called the game, which was used in Synanon for drug treatment purposes, and the idea is that as I've listened to the tape on Charles Dietrich explaining this, your work life is a triangle where the boss is at the top, and your community life is a circle, and in the circle we're all equals. And so when we play the game, you can say anything that, you know, you can say things that you might not be able to say to people who are at the top of the triangle. And you can
imagine how this goes.
Yeah. and essentially the point was to scream at people with as many obscenities as possible and indict them for some offense, generally something personal. And then everybody gangs up on that person. And then in order to get out of it, you have to sort of turn the focus to someone else. It was a very destructive process. And for a period of time, people were semi-required to play it every week.
Every week? Well, I'd forgotten that.
They all went to La Paz, the headquarters, on Saturdays to play the game.
Is it? It comes obviously at a point where the union seems to be sort of cracking, or at least the leadership. Is it? How much do you think that the sort of slide into that kind of acrimonious period is accelerated by? Is the game the result of that process, or is it the cause of that process, or both? I guess.
I think the game is a symptom, right, of the process. I think the game in and of itself came to symbolize a lot of the problems, and it was in some instances, I think, a factor that accelerated that. So, for example, the legal department, which the union had a very innovative, very smart group of lawyers who were quite instrumental in many of its successes. And when he wanted to basically blow up the legal department because it was not in La Paz in the headquarters, and because he felt they were becoming too independent, he required them to, they played the game. And within the legal department, that broke things apart in ways that I think, you know, certainly hastened its demise.
Just talk a little bit about the boycott. I mean, certainly as a young person growing up in California, the thing we knew about was the boycotts, right? It was grapes, lettuce, Gallo. What did the boycotts achieve? We were joking about there were grapes in the green room as we were coming together. There's a moment where you pause and think, am I allowed to eat grapes? Where did all that end up? Bottom line?
Talk about the first incarnation of the boycott was this absolutely brilliant strategy where the grape strike started in 1965 in Delano. And basically it had been going on for a couple of years. They were not successful in shutting down the production of grapes. There were not really that many people out on strike. It was an annoyance, it was a public relations problem, but it wasn't really affecting the sale of grapes. And so Chavez had this idea that you go to the retail end and you shut down the demand for grapes, and that's how you exert pressure on the growers. And the way he did it was to take farm workers, many of whom had never been on a plane, had not been outside of California, many of whom didn't speak English, and sent them around the country to organize boycotts. And essentially they sort of landed, and I tell the story of one of them in the book who went to Chicago with $100 and one name and had never been on it, no winter clothes, and was told to stop the sale of grapes. And, you know, you figure it out. And they did. I mean, that's really kind of the remarkable part of this. Not every, you know, the boycott had mixed success in different places. But this simple act, and this was sort of part of one of the issues that we can talk about later a little bit more, is the question of volunteerism, and that became one of the things that split the union apart. Really, also was the union had all volunteer staff for the most part. People worked for room and board and $5 a week. And one of Chavez's arguments in maintaining that was a pragmatic one, which was that when people come to you and say, you know, I'm a farm worker, I'm 3,000 miles from home, I'm not getting paid, and all I'm asking you to do is not buy grapes, or please could you shop someplace else where they don't sell grapes today, was tremendously powerful. People really responded to it. And so the boycott in that incarnation really did force the growers ultimately in 1970 to sign the first contracts. The later boycotts were less effective. The lettuce boycott was a lot harder. It's a lot easier to tell people could you buy some other fruit and not buy grapes. Lettuce is much more of a staple. People eat more lettuce. It's harder to get them to not buy lettuce. It was more confusing as to what lettuce was being boycotted. So in the later years, the boycott became a little more murky. But the threat of the boycott for growers was extremely powerful and forced them to change the way they did business in some ways. And for the larger corporations, it was a very powerful motivation. I mean, a lot of major companies that had other businesses, like they sold liquor, Shenley was a liquor distributor, but they also had grapes. They didn't want their major products to be boycotted, and so they were willing to sign a labor contract in order to buy that piece.
And did the boycotts, either the grapes or lettuce or any of the others, did they actually succeed in cutting down consumption of these products, or was it mainly the threat or fear of sort of being pilloried that convinced companies to react to them?
That's a complicated issue, and I don't have the total answer on that, because one of the things that happened is that the growers found other markets. Mm-hmm. So there were some ways in which it didn't effectively hurt them as much as it was an annoyance. But what it did do was really annoy their major retailers. Uh-huh. And so the pressure went onto the supermarket chain, which then basically went back to the growers and said, we just don't want these people in our parking lot anymore and coming to our house and, you know, having priests pray over the grapes in the lettuce aisles. And, you know, it just, you deal with this. Take care of your problems. One of the favorite boycott techniques that I always like to recall is, and maybe there are people here who did this, to take a shopping cart and put a lot of frozen goods in the bottom of it, as many as you could, and then pile it with canned goods and other stuff, and then go to the checkout counter and say, do you sell grapes here? And when they said yes, say, oh, well, then I can't shop here. And so they did lots of things like that really were, you know. So it was more of that the pressure came on the retailers, who then went back to the growers and said,
I mean, that has a kind of arguable morality to it. I mean, in the sense that these grocery stores are clearly not doing anything wrong.
But they said, we're just the middleman. Right. That was their line. But that's, I mean...
nature of it.
Yeah, and the argument was you have a responsibility to buy grapes. And when there were alternatives, where there were union contracts in some, like in lettuce, when the UFW had certain contracts, they could say, buy lettuce from these people and don't buy it from, the others.
Right. You mentioned this debate over volunteerism versus having a paid union staff. Describe how that sort of played out within the tensions of the union and what it did to the union.
One of the things that there are a lot of people who even today believe are mystified by what happened and like to believe that Cesar Chavez was one thing in the early years. It was a democratic operation. He was great. He cared about us. It was an interesting, everything was wonderful. And then something happened. He had a brain tumor. He went nuts. Something happened, because it's really hard for them to understand why he went off in this other direction, which was involved Synanon in the game and poor people's movement, and was not interested in the non-missionary work, which people who had been his supporters early on believed that they were there to do. I don't find any evidence to support that. I understand why people want to think that, but to me, he's very consistent throughout. And one of the things that he's very consistent about is the belief in the importance of sacrifice. He himself, as most people probably know, fasted and didn't take a salary and so on and so forth, and really believed in a very religious way that the ultimate goal was to sacrifice, and that workers needed to be educated, and he talks about this in the tapes at various points, that the goal is to educate workers to understand that sacrifice is what is the ultimate goal, not to become middle class, not to make more money, not to want a sort of middle-class existence, which was something that he personally had a lot of disdain for. So those values, you can see where there's a conflict between being a labor leader and, negotiating contracts for workers who want better wages and working conditions and a medical plan that efficiently gives them benefits and so on, and a sort of visionary leader whose idea is that sacrifice is the ultimate goal. And part of that was his belief that people should not be paid. Now, not being paid, it was usually couched as, we don't have money. If we had to pay people, we'd have a very small staff. So we were doing this for financial reasons. There's a lot of indication that it didn't really save the union any money, because they ended up paying people's college loans or paying their mortgages or doing other things, and obviously paying room and board and cars and so on. What it did do is make everyone utterly beholden to the union. I mean, you couldn't go out and buy a pair of shoes, because you had to go to the grab bag and you had to live where the union told you to live and so on and so forth. So it did certain things to hold people together and to give him a degree of control, in addition to his philosophical commitment to this idea. In the early years, I think that was fine. We're at war. Everything's crazy. We're all willing to do this. We're young people. It was the late 1960s and the early 1970s. It was a time when it was not hard to attract people to that lifestyle. But as people grew up, and they had families, and they wanted some degree of security, it was more difficult to sort of accept that existence. And as there were contracts to manage and administer and a medical plan to run, it also became very chaotic to do that with a volunteer staff, where people were coming and going, and you're the grower and you have a negotiation settled, and you never know whether the person who's going to show up to negotiate the contract is the same person who was there a month ago, because they may have quit or been reassigned or so on. So there became sort of a growing pressure from the people who were trying to do the administration of the union, and in some cases from the workers in the fields as well, that they wanted something that was a little bit more stable and that would involve paying money. And that was such an anathema to him for various reasons that it sort of deepened the fissures pretty quickly.
I mean, he really regarded that in some ways as a betrayal of people who saw it that way. That's in an odd way, and this sounds strange, but he seems miscast as a labor leader. I don't know really what better describes his role, but for someone who is so associated with this iconic union, he seems misplaced in it.
I think that he is a very heroic figure. I think he is an icon. He's an icon to a generation. He's an icon to a generation of Chicano kids in the cities who weren't involved in the farm worker struggle, but who saw him as someone who was a real role model and a hero. And all of that fine. And this, the book, I mean, I think you'd agree with this, the book does not take him down as a person in any sense. What it does do, though, is say that the accomplishments that in the fields were very short-lived, and that for farm work, this really wasn't in the end about what farm workers wanted. You know, and the farm, the rhetoric that one day the farm workers are going to run the union, you talk to those farm workers today who became leaders, you know, who came from Mexico, who had no control over their lives, for whom the union was what they refer to as the third way, that when you were a worker, you came and your choices, you know, in the 60s were to be a worker or to be the foreman. So you could sort of, that's what you could aspire to, right? You could be the exploited or the exploiter. And that for many people, the UFW was a third way. You know, it was the idea that you could be a worker and have certain rights and have certain dignity. And to this day, you hear workers from that generation talk about what it meant to them to be on a negotiating committee and to be sitting there in a room negotiating a contract with their employer. It was a tremendously empowering experience. But ultimately, you know, he took a set of actions that took the union in a direction that did not make that a lasting legacy.
I mean, you say in the very first sentence of the book, and I think we should go through it a sentence at a time, by the way. Now, the history of the United Farm Workers Union begins and ends with Cesar Chavez, and you go on. I mean, obviously, literally, still exists today. What do you mean by that? I mean,
it does exist on paper, so to speak. It has leadership. It really doesn't do much in the fields anymore, and much of what it does harkens back to Cesar. It's all about what Cesar did. They talk constantly about Cesar Chavez. And for farm workers today, you know, this is a standard line that gets repeated so often it's become a cliche, but if you ask farm workers who Cesar Chavez is, they think you're talking about the boxer, because there is a famous boxer by the same name. And he's not a concept to this generation, and yet the union has not been able to sort of move past that. And in many ways, you know, he was so instrumental to its success, and people were drawn in by him. And he was also the person who drove them out and who ultimately, you know, and that's not to say there weren't many other factors that were working against them. There were. There still are. And yet all those factors were there when he succeeded as well. There's a lot of rhetoric about blaming the Republican administrations that succeeded Jerry Brown for the difficulties that the workers faced, and all of that is true, and yet Richard Nixon was president and Ronald Reagan was governor during some of the years that the UFW achieved its greatest success. So the, you know, a hostile administration in and of itself was never a barrier in the years in which they had their greatest success.
I know we want to open it up to questions from you all, but before I give up my place here, let me just ask you, what's the reaction been to the book, both from within UFW and the labor movement generally, but and beyond?
For people in the book, it's been, in many ways, a really painful experience to read it, to relive a lot of the things that happened, and yet also a very cathartic experience. I mean, one of the most gratifying things, I was very nervous about the reaction of the people in the book, probably more than anything else, and because I felt that they had entrusted me to tell this story, and then I had a tremendous responsibility to do that in a way that they would respect and be comfortable with. And one of the most gratifying things to me has been that all of the major people in the book have said, you know, this is accurate. This is what happened. This is who I was. In some cases, they have said, I don't like the person that I was at that point in time. It's very hard for me to read that because it makes me wince, but it's true. It's what happened, and it's an important story, and people should read it and learn from it. So that response has been interesting. The other, just parenthetically, I've heard from a lot of children of people who are in the book, children of people who lived through the movement, who've read the book and sort of talk about what they learned about their parents and about their parents' generation and what it and understanding things. And a lot of the things that their parents talk about in the book were never discussed with them for the same reason of sort of it wasn't talked about. So that's been really interesting. The UFW themselves has not reacted at all. As you may recall, and some other people may recall, they when the stories ran in the paper, They sent out a message on their listserv to everybody saying, don't believe these stories that the LA Times is running, and they launched a very active, lengthy, and personal attack on me and threatened to sue the paper and so on. And I think that they felt that that ultimately backfired because it increased the attention to the stories, and they were determined this time to not do that. So they have not commented at all. And I think in the labor movement in general, you know, there's been some sense of the response among colleges has been really strong and interesting, and among young people who read the book, who, you know, for whom it's history and who don't know anything about it, that's been really interesting. I think there's been some reluctance on the part of the left to want it's sort of this, which was a response to the stories as well to some degree of which, well, we know about this and we just don't want to really know about it. I've also gotten people who didn't like the stories, were angry with me for writing the stories, but did like the book, didn't think they were going to like the book. Fernando Guerra, who's the head of the Loyola Marymount, said we did a thing together at Loyola Marymount Law School. He was my interlocutor. And he said then, you know, I didn't think I was going to like this book, but actually I did. Because it's not an attack in the way that people sort of expect it to be. It's a true, both inspiring and sad story.
And the book, more than the series, I think has a sort of rounder picture of the unit. For both, it's longer in time. For one thing, as you mentioned, there's the whole sort of triumphant early period right. chronicled in the book that really wasn't part of the series.
It's a completely different. I mean, the goal is to tell the story of the social movement, whereas in the paper, the goal was to talk about what was happening today. Uh-huh. I still do find there are a lot of people who think that farm workers are all covered under contracts, and the grape, when I talk, particularly in the East Coast also, it's like, well, we boycotted grapes. Didn't we fix all of this? Isn't it all okay now? So there's a degree to which I think it's useful to also relive this and remind people of what's going on today.
And we are now officially allowed to eat grapes and lettuce, right? Yeah. Both are off? Good. So you're clear to go.
Gallo wine,
right.
too.
And Gallo wine, right. Questions from all of you. I know you, well, the one caution I need to tell you is you need to wait for a microphone before you ask because they tape this. So, yes, right in front. We'll get you a microphone.
Good evening, Jim. Last time we saw each other was in the mountains.
It's very good to see you, right.
I'm very taken by a few things that I've already scanned through the book. And as a teacher, the first thing I did was go to the index to look for certain things. I'll comment on those on email to you.
Good.
I have mixed emotions about the book. One, because it's a little bit like growing up and finding out that your dad or your uncle weren't necessarily the guys that you thought they were. You still love them, but you have issues about some things. I can attest to the fact that some of the people that I know that aren't in the book quite well. Having private conversations express some of these things, so I think that it'll be difficult to challenge your veracity. I think there's some things that do concern me, one from the standpoint of perhaps I don't get enough sense as to how Cesar Chavez, as an icon or as a person, truly impacted the Chicano movement. Mm-hmm. And how that has led to some of the political growth development, such as it is, of Latino politicians, most of whom I think probably cut their teeth on those picket lines in front of Vons and Safeway back in those days, as I did. The other part of it is, I'm curious as to how you focused on Chris and some of the others, mm-hmm. but I don't see Dolores Huerta here, maybe for obvious reasons. But I don't see her there. Tony Arandine, I don't know if he and any of the Filipinos were spoken to about the movement. So I'm very, very curious to continue reading your book, and I'd like to correspond with you about some things.
Great. Let me quickly try to respond to both of those. They're really good points. There is a whole role. I completely agree with you in terms of his role in the Chicano movement. That's an important story. I tried to limit the scope of the book. Part of the reason I told it through these characters was also that they, in some sense, therefore limited the scope so that I wasn't writing an 800-page tome that nobody was going to read. So it is, you know, and I say in the preface, this is one piece of the story. The Filipinos is a tremendously important story. Tony Orendon, Texas, Arizona, all of that, I agree, that's not in the book because I tried to, you know, make it something that would be readable and accessible. So I agree with all of that. I should say about how I picked the characters, because that's an interesting thing. There are eight characters, and each of them is an interesting story in and of themselves and has this trajectory where they come into the movement in one way and in one place and at one age, and they change over time and they leave as somebody else. And that was, so one of my goals was to pick people who were interesting stories, each in, you know, that you would care about. The second was that they're each in some sense an archetype for the worlds they came together. And one of the things we haven't talked about really tonight is that one of the remarkable things about the movement and one of the reasons that it succeeded was that it brought together people from so many different worlds and so many spheres. And so I wanted, through these people, to have a minister, a lawyer, a housewife, a student, and so on and so forth, and workers. And then the last thing is, to me, you know, I wrote this book for the farm workers, I mean, in some sense, because it is, I think, ultimately the last part of the book, which is about some of the leaders in the fields who came out of the 1979 strike in the lettuce fields in Salinas, and what happened to them is, I think, the most heartbreaking part in many ways, because they were or could have been the future of the union. And so, to me, that sort of shaped the story, and, you know, that's why I tried to keep the focus on the fields and on the farm workers and not, and that's another reason why I didn't do the biography, because the biography is a whole different book, and it is about Chicano leadership and Chavez's role and all of that. And the web, the other thing, as you said, because you're a teacher, so before I forget, I have a website, which is www.unionoftheirdreams.com. So it's the name of the book without the first "the." And there's a lot of information on it that is not in the book, that's additional. There are photographs and audio clips and links to other sources of information. And also some of the primary source documents that I used in the book I put up online and can be linked to. So it's a great resource for anybody who's interested in the subject and also especially for teachers.
Can you listen to the tapes online?
I put clips on of each person. Okay. I didn't put the whole tapes on, yeah. But just so that you could hear the voices of the people in the book, just to see what they sound like.
I'm just curious, this is sort of off the point, but when you listen to these tapes, how long did it take you before you could recognize people's voices?
Not very long.
Is that right? Really?
Yeah.
Is that quick?
It's really, yeah. It's pretty easy.
That's interesting.
Next.
You talk about the workers who wanted to go the third way, and it seems to me that the third way, I may be wrong, I'd like you to define where you see the divergence between a civil rights movement, between a civil rights movement and a labor union movement. Because when you described the third way, it seemed to be the perfect intersection of both, which to me as a young person at that time seemed, they didn't seem like separate goals to me.
I think that's true for a lot of people who were in the movement, that they did not seem like separate goals. It became clearer later that they were in the sense of the decisions that had to be made about priorities for the UFW. And, you know, the example of paid staff is a good example. So that, you know, if the union had a medical plan, which it did, and it was being run by volunteers and checks were not being, people, you know, workers would put in for reimbursement and not get paid for years and have their credit ratings ruined. For the workers, that became an important issue, that they needed the medical plan to run efficiently. And that would have required making different decisions on the part of the union leadership. So that's where the split manifest, how the split manifests itself. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but in the sense, I agree that I don't think that there is anything necessarily that about a movement and a labor union that cannot coexist. And certainly for many people, what made the UFW an important labor union and an important experience was the movement aspect of it. And it was La Causa, and that was a piece of it. And that was certainly part of the attraction for workers as well as for the volunteers. So it's later on in the more practical aspects that the decisions that would have had to be made about having a labor union that functioned in a more efficient manner, you know, the legal department is a good example. If you deliberately go out and basically get rid of your legal department, you are hurting the ability of the union to continue to exist and to grow. Does that answer the question?
Like a philosophical disconnect.
It was bad management, but it was driven by a philosophical disconnect because those were not priorities. You know, had they been priorities, there would have been other ways to address it. I know this guy. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Miriam.
Hi.
I'm Mark Coleman. I actually was in the UFW during 1975, 1977, and this is my wife, Shelley Spiegel, who's in the book, who was unceremoniously fired by Caesar in La Paz in 1976. And I would just, I think that everyone is wise to listen to what Miriam says about this is a version of the story. And I'm reminded reading your book of Lawrence Durrell's novel, The Alexandria Quartet, where you read one novel, one aspect of the novel, the first one, and you think you understand what happened and the characters in Alexandria at the time. And you read the second volume, and you realize from another person's perspective that everything you learned in the first volume was wrong. And then you read the third volume, and yet another view of reality emerges. And that, I think, and then the fourth volume as well. And you realize after you've read all four volumes that there's still another story to be told that would change your perception of what happened. And so I would urge people to read Goliath by Fred Ross, another version of Cesar Chavez, another story of Cesar Chavez. And it's, you know, in some ways, I think, and I noticed this in going to the funeral procession for Cesar in 1992, there's a whole safety battle of this and dissecting it inside of an auditorium that was completely absent during those days. There was a danger everywhere. You know, there was a danger in the fields. There was a danger from the Teamsters. There was a danger at the supermarkets. There was a danger from police. And so you're dealing with a very embattled set of circumstances and things happening in that context. And it being the 60s and 70s, it likewise created a certain milieu in which the game didn't seem that weird. You know, today it seems like a sort of aberrant behavior, but playing it inside of, you know, a world where we were doing encounter groups and men's groups and women's groups, it didn't seem that strange. And, you know, as having lived through this and having lived in La Paz and all that as well, not everything is consistent with some of the things that are put forth in the book. For example, the law. Maybe Caesar opposed it initially, but when the funding stopped in 76 rather, and Caesar was faced with sort of the loss of the effectiveness of the law, he devoted all of the resources of the Union to passing the initiative that would qualify Prop 14. So at some point, at any rate, it became apparent he did support the law and that we were spending huge amounts of resources in the fields organizing elections. And if he really wanted the law to go away, we never would have devoted all of our resources, my opinion, in 1976, towards an initiative that had one sole objective, which was to restore the funding to the Act. So I think there's some inconsistencies, and I also think that what you get from the book from Caesar and some of the other characters is there is more complexity in reality, having lived through it with them and knowing them, than is portrayable, perhaps, through the book. But I just would caution people to read and to read the book, not to think they understand necessarily what was happening, but they understand from those people's perspectives, which are all true, what they saw and what they experienced. So I don't know if you.
I think that's a great point. I mean, yes, of course, you can't capture the complexity of these people in a 300-page book. I think that's true. I tried to capture a piece of it that would be recognizable as true and accurate. Is there a lot more there? Yes, of course. The Goliath book is a great book. It is not at all, it covers a completely different time period than this book does. It covers Caesar's early years as an organizer with a community service organization, and it's a wonderful little case study in how he learned about organizing in Oxnard in the late 1950s. I also would say that I think that that book is very relevant and that Chavez's experience in the community service organization was very important in shaping his views of the Union, because in the community service organization, He was not, it was a very decentralized operation. Chapters had a lot of local control over what they did. He was the national director, but he didn't really have the power to control the agenda of the local chapters. And it was about empowering Mexican Americans in various parts of both the cities and the rural areas of California. And his experience there, in which many of these chapters, particularly in the cities, as people became empowered, what they wanted was to be middle class. And that became the goal of the CSO chapters. And he rails consistently about that because, again, back to the sort of sacrifice theme, that was really anathema to him. And he talks a lot about not wanting to ever be in that position again. And many of the decisions that he made in the UFW and the way in which it was structured, in terms of his also tremendous central control over things, were a response to his earlier experiences in CSO. And the only other postscript I'd add on that book, if anyone reads it, is it has a wonderful happy ending where he succeeds in the era of braceros in organizing these workers in Oxnard. But 6 months later, when he goes back after he's left, it all gets undone. And that was another sort of issue for him. You touched on one other point I wanted to make. Oh, the law. Just we can debate this independently. But the point about Prop 14 became this tremendous fight, but again, it was a fight, and that's the milieu in which he was the most comfortable. And he devoted all these resources to fighting to get this on the ballot and then to pass it when that fight was no longer necessary because the legislature had restored funding for the ALRB. So there was a way, and many people even at the time were sort of, why are we fighting this battle when it's already been won and we can go back now and run elections? So I'm not sure that the Prop 14 experience really was, you know, inconsistent with what I'm saying. And yeah, he accepted the law. It was, you know, that there was not much choice about going out and doing elections, but his heart was not in it. And when you listen to the tapes, there are these discussions over and over about the non-missionary. How are we going to get people to do this? Maybe we should recruit alcoholics in the cities who will come and be part of this community, because we're not going to get people who want to go out and do this sort of mundane non-missionary work involved in the contracts. Where are we going to get them from?
Time for maybe two more. You had one down here, right, sir? You were still going to go ahead.
Jay Christensen, California State University, Northridge, retired. I'm interested in Robert F. Kennedy and the pictures that we saw of Robert F. Kennedy at the time with Cesar Chavez. Mm-hmm. What attracted Kennedy so much to Cesar Chavez? Was it just for political gain, or was it something else?
You know, I'm not an expert on Robert Kennedy. He played a very important role in the early years. There's this great scene of him coming as a senator and holding a hearing in which he questions the sheriff who has been arresting people. And I can't get the wording right, but essentially the sheriff says, I arrested those people because somebody told me that they were going to break the law. And Kennedy says, I suggest during the break that you go and read the Constitution of the United States, right? And you know, Kennedy was about to run. This was all in 1968. He was about to announce that he was running. The UFW did support Kennedy and did a lot of work during that election and was critical to his success in the California primary. So I assume that he certainly thought it had some political benefit, but it also is consistent with, you know, his values.
Thank you. One more? Yes.
I have two questions. The first, can you talk about if there are any parallels between what happened with the UFW back then and other unions, for example, HRE? And then secondly, can you speak to the current movement around localism for food and whether or not, for example, at the Santa Cruz Farmers Market, the Swenson berries, mm-hmm. the strawberries, is one of the only...
Right.
berries that it has a union contract,
right.
And that's how they separate themselves out from all of the other organic and local berries. So is UFW currently using that emphasis on localism to their benefit now?
When you say HRE, do you mean HRE today, or HRE, is that... you know, I think that there are many, I mean, one of the great legacies of the United Farm Workers while not in the field, is this generation of people who learned how to organize and came of age during the UFW and went on to work for other unions. And HERE and SEIU are two of the places where many of the people who came out of the UFW ended up. So, and many of them brought with them some of the tactics and strategies and things that they had learned there. So I think there is a, there are other unions, and those would be the two that come to mind offhand that most adapted techniques and strategies of the UFW. I don't think that the UFW is doing, they're not doing anything in terms of promoting their contracts. In fact, they won't even give out a list of the contracts that they have. They don't have very many. So they're not, the way that Swanson's is using it to advertise their product, I don't know of anybody else who's doing that. I have not seen that happen.
Well, listen, I want to thank you all for coming this evening. I want to especially thank my friend Miriam for this wonderful book, and I hope you all read it. And I know I personally am looking forward to introducing the game at the Los Angeles Times. So. Thank you, Miriam.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.